Okay, the exam is passed. Now we're going to look to the future. But it's not irrelevant, the past, because if there are things that you were weak on, it's good to catch up because things are cumulative in the course. And it's too early to rest on your laurels if you did very well on this exam. Congratulations, but there's a lot more to come. And there's a lot more time to make up for any deficiencies that the exam revealed. Okay, so just to see what's coming for the next exam, we're talking about atoms now. But we talked in the first lecture of this quarter of the course about the how orbitals can't possibly be right. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how you can still talk about orbitals, even though fundamentally they must be wrong. And then we'll go on to molecules. Okay, so today we'll talk about plum pudding molecules, which essentially nobody else talks about, but it's just a little side trip. Then we'll go on to how to understand bonds, which is, of course, our purpose. And we'll talk about pairwise linear combination of atomic orbitals to understand what bonds are. And then to the concepts of energy match and overlap, which are key to understanding bonding. And then we'll have a reality check by looking at some experiments and see how they line up with the theory we've developed involving XH3 molecules, BH3, CH3, NH3. Then we'll get on to reactivity and the idea of highest occupied molecular orbitals and lowest unoccupied molecular orbitals, and recognizing functional groups, which is the point of all this, so that you can look at some set of atoms and know how it will react at the beginning without having to memorize it. And then we'll completely change tack, right? And we're going to go back then to find out how organic chemistry really developed, because it didn't develop from theory, okay? So that'll be, it's interesting in particular because it relates to the nomenclature of organic chemistry, because it all developed historically. And if you understand how it developed, not only do you get a better concept of what science is, but you can understand nomenclature better. Anyhow, with atoms. Last time we saw that you couldn't write a two-wave electron wave function as a product of orbitals. So it looks like we're in a very bad situation, right? So remember, had we been able to write orbitals, we would have had paradise, but it's disappeared. But what we're going to see today is how there are tricks that still allow you to talk about orbitals so you could get a little way back toward paradise. Okay, the first thing that people used historically was called Z-effective. And the idea of this is that the problem, remember, is that electrons repel one another, right? So but if you try to find an orbital, what's an orbital? I hear you say it's a one electron wave function. So if that one electron wave function will depend on potential energy, we've seen that, right? That's what quantum mechanics problems are, right? So the potential energy is due not only to the nucleus. If it were only due to a nucleus, we got that, right? We can write down those wave functions. But it's due to the other electrons as well. So it was a very crude first approximation. Pretend that the other electrons are part of the nucleus, right? So all that would do is change the charge of the nucleus. So that in some way takes into account that there's repulsion by the other electrons. It's a crude way to do it, but it's worth a try. Okay, so we know that that's the form of, for example, the 1s orbital of a hydrogen-like atom. And what we'll do if we change the nuclear charge, we'll decrease the nuclear charge, and that will cause the orbital we're interested in to expand. We've seen that before when we were talking about scaling, right? So what we need to know is how much are we going to reduce the nuclear charge? The obvious thing would be to put all of that other electron on the nucleus. But not all of it is at the nucleus, right? So the question is, how much should we pretend is at the nucleus in order to get the best picture we can of the one electron, the orbital we're looking for? Okay, so Clementi and Raimondi, who were at IBM and had access to what passed for a really fancy computer in those days, which isn't nearly as powerful as your laptop, in 1963 did more complicated things that took a long time to calculate then, to see what would the best charge be that would give an orbital whose energy and shape looked pretty much like what much better calculations do that actually do take into account electron-electron repulsion in a better way. Okay, and they found, for example, for helium with its two electrons, if you're looking at just one electron and want to put the other one at the nucleus to get this one electron you're looking for to look as close to reality as possible, you make the nuclear charge 1.69 instead of 2. You don't lower it to 1. That's what you'd get if you put the other electron entirely at the nucleus. But you put some of the other electron at the nucleus. Not very much. 1.69 isn't very different from 2, but it causes the orbital to expand a little bit. So that was the best fit they could get for helium. Now, if you do carbon with 6Z, then for the 1S, if you're calculating the 1S orbital, you pretend the nuclear charge is almost 6. There's very little of the other electron density that's inside the 1s orbital, right? But when you get to the 2s orbital, you take away a little more than 2 electrons. 2 electrons from the core, which really is down inside near the nucleus, as you know, the 1s's are really down there. But a little bit of the other electron, too, the other electrons are shielding the nucleus, as you say. So it's 3.22. Now, if you're talking about a 2p orbital, you use a slightly different nuclear charge, 3.14, to get something that looks as close as possible to the way electron distribution calculated in a more realistic way looks, right? Now, notice that 2s is slightly less screened. You say that these electrons go in and screen the electron you're looking at so it doesn't see the full nuclear charge, right? But notice that you have a slightly larger effective nuclear charge for 2s than you do for 2p. And this has to do with the fact that the 2s and the 2p have different energy, right? It's the electron-electron repulsion that gives them different energies. If you just had one electron, remember we said they'd have the same energy. And we can see how that is here. There's what the 2s electron distribution looks like. And this is its radial distribution, as we saw before, right? And here's what the 2p looks like. Now, notice that the 2s has this little lump here that's down near the nucleus. So other electrons don't tend to get inside that. So they don't shield this part of the electrons seeing the nucleus, right? There's what the 1s electrons are doing. So these are down even closer than most of the 1s electrons. So they're not shielded quite as much as this is, right? But it's hard to know because, you know, this part of this one is further out than this. This part is further in. It's hard to just eyeball it and see what the balance would be. And in fact, if you go to sodium, you find out the opposite is true. There's a little bit greater screening of 2s of 2s than of 2p. And of course the 3s, which is further out, is very highly screened. So this is a way you could try in a klutzy sort of way to make up for the fact that you're not considering electron-electron repulsion properly. Right? This is a very subtle question though, that these small differences. Right, and this is a pretty crude approach. So you're not going. It's better than nothing, but it's not what you want to get. So what did people do next? They did what was called self-consistent field, or SCF. And in fact, most calculations that are done nowadays are still of this kind. Okay. Now this is a recipe for going through and calculating one electron at a time. So here's the approach. First, you find approximate orbitals for all the electrons. For example, you could use these Z effectives that we talked about. Then that becomes a one-electron problem. You can write down the hydrogen-like functions, which you know how to do from your table. The only thing you do is put in a different nuclear charge for each orbital. Okay, so you find all these orbitals. Now you know sort of roughly how these electrons are distributed, each of the electrons. Okay. Now, second, you try to calculate a better wave function for just one of the electrons. So you choose one of the electrons, and now for its potential energy, you don't pretend that it's Z effective, that the other electrons are partially at the nucleus. What you pretend is that those other electrons are in the cloud that you calculated for them in step one, right? But it's a fixed cloud. It doesn't change its shape. The electrons don't move around. Okay? So now the potential energy is due to the nucleus and the fixed clouds from all the other electrons. Now, it's sort of complicated. You need a computer to do it. But now you know what the potential energy would be for the one electron you're interested in, wherever it is. It's the attraction to the nucleus and the repulsion from these other clouds. Okay? So you can calculate, you can imagine that you can calculate a wave function for that one electron because you know its potential energy is a function of position. I mean, it's harder than one dimension, but it can be done. Okay? So now you have a good, at least a better wave function for that one electron. But the others are still the original crude approximation, Z effective. Everybody with me? What do you do next? Yeah, Chris? Pardon me? Pick another electron and do the same, but it's going to be better than the first one. Why?
Because you already have this.
Yeah, you have a better wave function for one of the electrons. So when you go to a next electron and calculate that, you're doing a better job than you did with the first electron. Okay? So you use this new potential to calculate an improved orbital for that one electron that you started with, and then you repeat steps 2 and 3, right? For the orbital of another electron, and it's going to be even better than the first one. And then what do you do? What do you do next? Lauren, what do you do next? Yeah, go to another electron, right, and do it. And then? Right, you cycle through the electrons, improving them all. So now you've improved all the electrons, and it now is much better than it was at the beginning when you had this crude Z-effective shape. Okay, now what do? Go back and cycle through it again, right? So you do it again and again and again and again and again, and it's good to have a computer to do this rather than to do it on a piece of paper, right? And then at some place you have to quit. When will you quit? Wojtek? When things stop changing, the energy stops changing and the shape stops changing. So you quit when the orbital shapes and energy stop changing. And at that point, you say that these shapes are self-consistent. That's why it's called self-consistent field, right? They're consistent with one another. Okay? So now you have a much, much better, and this can be quite useful, okay? Much better than this Z-effective approach, right? Is it correct? Once you get self-consistency, do you now have the real McCoy? Or can you see a problem with it? What's the fundamental assumption? That for calculating one, the potential of one electron, all the other electrons stay fixed in the shape of a cloud. Okay, is that true? Carl, why not? Right. When the one electron you're interested in moves around, it pushes the other electrons. So their clouds change their shape as the electron you're interested in moves. So you have a much better approximation of the potential than you did before. But it's still not really right. Right? It's wrong because real electrons are not fixed clouds. They keep out of each other's way. They correlate their motion. How one moves depends on how another moves. Okay? So the true energy is going to be lower than what you calculated by self-consistent fields because the electrons know how to keep out of each other's way, which your fixed clouds don't do. Everybody see that? So there's going to be a difference between the true energy and what you calculate by this approach, which is what you usually get when you use my... I'll show you pictures of orbitals as we go along, and they're usually done with self-consistent field approach, right? But the energies are going to be a little bit too high because the electrons are smarter than we are, and they can keep out of each other's way dynamically in their motion, okay? So, what do we do about this error? Right? There's this error if you use this approach. There has to be this error. What do we do about it? Okay? So you conceal this error so that naive people don't know you're making it. And the way you do it is after you've done a full self-consistent field round and round and round until it's self-consistent and things stop changing. And that's called the Hartree-Fock limit, if you want to have a fancy name for it when it stops changing. But you give the error a fancy name, and then people think, wow, how sophisticated is that? Right? And the name you give it is correlation energy. Right? So that's you know, electrons don't know from correlation energy. Right? That's something that we talk about. Right? It's the mistake we made. Electrons just naturally stay away from each other. But anyhow, they give this the name correlation energy, the error you make. Okay. Now, where do you get the correct energy and the correct total electron distribution? Where do you get it? From experiment, right? From X-ray, for example, you get what the true electron density is, right? So you can get it by experiment or by a much more complex calculation, right? That takes into account how the electrons can move around. And one way of doing that is called configuration interaction, and that's all we're going to say about it, that there's a way of doing it. And there's another way of doing it, which is called density functional theory. And you can those are becoming more popular calculations. They're much more complicated. So it waited for computers and programs to get more wrapped faster and more sophisticated. But nowadays, you can do that for many molecules. Okay, but still, but at that point, it becomes so complicated what the computer's doing that it's very hard to think about what is it really telling you, what's really going on. So what our thoughts are going to be based on self-consistent field ideas, right? But we'll always be aware that there's this correlation energy error we're making. Now, wouldn't it be great if it turned out that this correlation energy was negligible, that it was so small it didn't make any difference, right? Then we would be in good shape doing what we're going to be doing. Okay, so is it negligible? Well, let's look at the scale of energies that are involved in molecules. Should we care about the error that is in orbital theory? Remember, orbital is one electron wave function, which is it's a wave function for one electron, and that can happen only if electron-electron interaction is not taking place, right? So orbital theory intrinsically has this error associated with it, correlation energy. But if it's small, we might not care. Okay, so let's look at these energy magnitudes. First, if you're going to make a molecule, you start with protons, neutrons, and electrons, right? First, you put protons and neutrons together to give nuclei, right? So they come together, zap, energy comes out, right? That's nuclear energy. That's what makes atomic bombs and so on. So, and in fact, it loses so much energy, according to E equals mc squared, that it loses mass, right? That's a lot of energy, okay? So in forming the nucleus of a carbon atom, you give off 2 times 10 to the 9th kilocalories per mole. That's a lot of energy. That's what makes the bombs go. Okay, so now you have a carbon nucleus. And then you're going to put 2 electrons on it, 1s electrons, to give the core of the carbon atom. And that is another 2 times 10 to the 4th kilocalories per mole. But notice it's negligible compared to the nuclear energy. Right? It's a very tiny energy. But now if you put the next 4 valence electrons onto carbon, right, that gives you only an order of magnitude less energy. Right, so only a tenth as much energy as the electrons. This is 4 electrons. 2 electrons going on the nucleus are 10 times as big. Okay, and then you can use the atom to make bonds with other atoms. Now, of course, the energy involved in making a bond, if you want to get the energy of a molecule, half of it you can say comes from this atom and half from this. If you gave all the energy to this one and also all the energy to this one, you'd have too much energy. So half of making 4, each, a single bond is roughly 100 kilocalories. Okay? So if you make four of them, four halves of 100 is 200, right? So it's another order of magnitude. So bonding is small potatoes compared to forming atoms. Can you think of any experimental evidence of that? That bonding isn't a big deal compared to forming atoms? I can't hear very well. That's true, but there's something we've talked about in class that shows you that. Yeah. Right. If you look at the electron density, it looks just like atoms. You have to look very carefully with these difference maps to see that the molecule is any different. And that's part of the reason that this is 10 times smaller. Okay? And then you can have molecules come together and attract one another, not forming bonds, what's called non-bonded interactions or attractions, right? And those are between 1 and 20 kilocalories per mole, so another order of magnitude smaller. And the weakest of all is two helium atoms. You know, helium atoms, if you press them tightly together, repel, right? But in fact, there's an energy minimum, and the energy minimum is at 52 angstroms, right? 52 times as big as the hydrogen-hydrogen bond. There's an energy minimum, but it's a very shallow energy minimum. That bond is worth only 10 to the minus 6th kilocalories per mole, right? It's nothing compared with thermal temperature, so heliums don't stick together. Okay, now all of these things at the bottom depend on Coulomb's law. The one at the top is different, right? The nuclear energy, it doesn't depend on Coulomb's law. There are other forces that apply there, the strong force and the weak force of physics. Okay, and gravity is nothing on any of these scales, even a helium-helium scale. Okay, but notice that if you had a little change, a very, very small fractional change in the nuclear energy when you formed a molecule, that would completely overwhelm everything else, right? If you made a thousandth of a percent change in the nuclear energy when a molecule formed, that would overwhelm all these other things. But fortunately, you don't. The nuclear energy is totally unchanged during chemical transformations, so even though it's enormous, we can forget it. Okay? Now, that same thing might be true of correlation energy. It might be that correlation energy, even if big, of course, we're going to see how big it is, but even if it were big, as long as it doesn't change when you make and break bonds, you could still ignore it the same way you ignore nuclear energy. So, first, how big is it? Well, this error that you make when you do self-consistent field calculations is about as strong as a bond. So it certainly isn't negligible in terms of its size. It's as big as bonds are, right? But maybe it won't change as you move atoms around, in which case we can ignore it the same way we ignore nuclear energy, right? So the correlation energy is about the same as a bond. And changes in the correlation energy when you do reactions, however, can be 10 to 15%. So 10 to 15% of bond energy can be the error you're making, right? So if you need to know things pretty accurately, right, then you're going to have to do better. You're going to have to correct for this error. But if you just want to understand generally how things work, and you're satisfied with being 90% of the correct answer, then you can use self-consistent field, and that's what we're going to do. So we can use orbitals and self-consistent field and get 90% roughly of the correct answer, which is going to show fundamentally what bonds are, right? But it's not going to give really precise answers that we need sometimes for chemistry. Okay, so that means orbital theory is fine for qualitative understanding of bonding, right? And in fact, these non-bonded contacts and the helium-helium are exactly due to correlation. Because if you have two helium atoms at 52 angstroms, a great distance from one another, the electrons are moving around them, they have no net charge, so there's no Coulombic attraction or repulsion at that distance, right? But as the electron goes around this one, it has a dipole moment, right? A separation of positive and negative charge, and the same thing here. And it's a little bit better when this electron is to the left to have this electron to the left. You can see that. So if they correlate their motion, the electrons will move in phase, right? And there'll be a really weak attraction between the two. And that's exactly correlation. It's how one moves influences how the other moves. So this really weak bond at an enormous distance is due to that. And in fact, these non-bonded contacts, when you're not making bonds but things attract one another and become a liquid instead of a gas, that also has to do often with correlation of the electrons. Okay, so it can be important. But for understanding bonds, which is our goal, we can do okay, right? We can talk about orbitals. So orbitals can't be true if you have more than one electron because of electron-electron repulsion, but still we'll use them to try to understand bonding and structure, energy and reactivity. Now, if we want to do things precisely, we'll have to resort to experiment to measure things or do much fancier calculations that don't have this correlation energy error. Now, let's use orbitals and see some interesting things. Like, we can calculate the total electron density, because if we have now an orbital that describes this electron, an orbital that describes the second electron. If we square this one, we get its probability density where electron one is. Do the other one, we get the density of electron two. How would you get the total density at a given position? Noel, what do you say? You know what electron density 1 is, right? Because you've got it from the orbital, you square it. You know at that same point what the electron density of electron 2 is. Same approach. How do you get the total? This is not a hard question. You add them. So you square the first one, then square the second one. What are they functions of? Position. So you take a position where I'm interested in what's the total electron density. I find what the density of electron 1 is at that position. I plug the same coordinates into the other function, find its electron density, I add them together and I get the total electron density. So we could get what the total electron density of an atom looks like, right? By take the functions for each of its orbitals done by this self-consistent field way. Then add them together and see what the total electron density looks like, which is, of course, what you measure by X-ray is the total. You don't see it orbital by orbital. Okay, so the total density is the sum of those two squared. Okay? So notice it's a sum, not a product. And that makes sense. You're adding the two to get the total. And it's not a question, when we were doing a product, it was a question of whether we could get the joint probability. What's the probability that electron 1 is here when electron 2 is here? That was the orbital product, right? But that's not what we're interested in here. We're interested in the total density. Okay, now, you've seen pictures of atoms that look like that. Here's a nitrogen atom. Let's suppose it has one electron in each of its p orbitals, right? So what does it look like? This is a picture I took out of a text that some of you have, right? And if you took this atom and rolled it along the desk, it would go brrrr, right? Is that truly the shape? Does it look like that? Well, we have the means of finding out because we know what the density of a p orbital looks like. Right? We have the function for it. It's the px orbital is x times e to the minus rho over 2. You square it and you get what the x density is. And you can do the same thing for the y orbital and the z orbital. And how are we going to get the total? Noel? Add them together. So we got that. What does that look like? Can you see what the shape of that is? Obviously, that means it's going to fall away as you go away from the nucleus. But what's the shape as you go? What's it going to sound like when I roll it across the bench? Exactly. Because x squared plus y squared plus z squared is r squared. It doesn't depend on what angle you're going. It's only how far out it is. So it's spherical. It doesn't look like that at all if you have all three electrons there. Okay, so that's sort of cute. So it doesn't look like that. Okay, and remember we had one of these puzzles when we were looking at electron density, that CN triple bond. We thought it might look lumpy as you go around in cross-section. It might be like a four-leaf clover, right? If we cut and turn 90 degrees, it might look like that. But in fact, that's x squared plus y squared, right? It's not a clover leaf nor a diamond, because the px squared plus y squared depends on x squared plus y squared. So it's symmetrical about the nucleus. It's only how far away you are from the axis, not which direction away from the axis, right? So that's perfectly symmetrical, and that's what you see experimentally. So we've solved one of our questions from earlier about these funny way things looked. Okay, so that's how we can go about trying to recover from the orbital approximation. All right, now we, having understood atoms, so to say, we'll move on to molecules, right? Now, so we want to understand what bonds are, and we're going to understand them in terms of pairwise linear combination of atomic orbital, molecular orbitals. But we're not going to do that today. It'll involve orbital or overlap and energy match. But first, we're going to do an aside about understanding computer-generated molecular orbitals, which don't look like bonds. When you use one of these programs to generate orbitals, they don't look like bonds, right? They're not between atoms. They look more like plum pudding. So we're going to talk today about plum pudding molecular orbitals, what's called the united atom limit. Now, what gives electrons their shape? Remember what Thomson said was that the electron, the atom, was a sphere of positive charge in which you embedded electrons, right? Now, we now know that what's spread out is the negative charge, not the positive charge these ways. But what is it that causes them to spread out? Why doesn't the electron spend all its time at the nucleus? You know that now. What would the energy be like if the electron were only at the nucleus? The potential energy would be great. How about the kinetic energy? What would the wave function look like? It would look like this. Boom, 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 right? It would be really curved. So it would have enormous kinetic energy. So the kinetic energy is what causes the thing to spread out, so it's smoother, not as curved, right? So that's what spread it, and it also gives it its shape. These nodes come from the waves, right? So the shape and the spreading out come from kinetic energy. And Schrödinger tells us that. So the node in the 2s orbital is because of kinetic energy. And in the case of this d orbital, those cones in that sphere are due to kinetic energy, right? Of course, potential energy has something to do with it. As you increase the charge of the nucleus, you suck things in. We know that. And saw that if you doubled the nuclear charge, it would shrink the thing in like that. But kinetic energy has a lot to do with what orbitals look like. That's the point. Except for the scaling, the kinetic energy is what's doing it. So let's look at a molecule. Now, almost every culture has this story, at least everyone that knows about elephants, of the blind men looking at an elephant, and one said it looks like a snake, and one said it looks like, I don't know, a wastebasket or something, right? But the same thing is true of a molecular orbital. So here are the electron density contours. This is what is in principle available experimentally, the total electron density for H2. Right? Now, in trying to understand it, you could look at different contours. I could assign one to you, one to you, one to you, one to you, one, and say, what does it look like? Okay? But looking at different contours, you see different things. Right? Which contour should you use? Well, suppose you chose a really high density contour. Then it just looks like two atoms. Right? And that's what you see in most X-ray things. If you look at the total electron density and look at where the high density contours are, it looks like a set of normal atoms. So that, in that, from that point of view, the molecule is a set of atoms. Okay? But you could choose a different one. You could choose that contour, and then you see a little extra stuff in the middle, right? 0.05 Lewis, as we saw before, of extra stuff in the middle. So that's fundamentally atoms. But they're slightly distorted, as we see in difference density maps. to put a little extra electron density in between. So that the person who chose that contour would say a molecule comes from a set of atoms with a little bit of shift of electron density, right? But if someone else, and that's what we'll usually look at, okay? But somebody else might choose that way out contour and say a molecule looks like an atom. It's roughly spherical, right? High in the middle and it falls as you go out. So that would be a molecule as an atom. It's just like an atom. Of course, it's a little different from an atom because the nucleus has been split, right? So the nucleus flies out, and of course that distorts the electrons because the electrons tend to follow the nucleus as it splits out the pieces. Okay? So this is the point of view we're going to take today, and then we're going to go to other points of view. But because I'm interested in your having an intuitive feel for what's involved in quantum mechanics, and the kinetic energy is what's special about quantum mechanics, I think it's really valuable to look at this for just a little while in the rest of the lecture today. So this is, notice, nuclei embedded in a cloud of electrons. And the electrons have their shape, they're spread out and given nodes by kinetic energy. So this is just like Thomson's plum pudding atom, except it's a molecule. Instead of a cloud of positive charge with electrons in it, it's a cloud of negative charge with nuclei in it. So it's worth a quick look. That's incidentally what a plum pudding looks like. It was once served me as dessert, and so I took a picture of it. So you can see little plums in there. Okay, so let's first look at methane and ammonia and pretend they are molecules, they are atoms. And which orbital is which? Okay, because we want to understand visually what's going on. So each of them has four pairs of valence electrons and another two electrons, 1s of carbon, as you know. Okay, so what we'll compare them with is neon, which has a core, two core electrons, and then four electron pairs, so the same number of orbitals is necessary for neon as for methane as for ammonia. The only difference is you've pulled protons out of the nucleus of the neon and put them out here someplace to be hydrogen, so the nuclear charge has gone down in the center and you have protons around it. So what does this do? So there's the 1s orbital, the core orbital of neon, right? And here's the 1s orbital of CH4. And there's that's the lowest, and it's contoured, I think, I have to check that, at 0.001 electrons per cubic angstrom. Remember, if you chose different densities, you'd get different contours. Okay, and here's what it looks like for ammonia. Okay, now, these are core orbitals. They're essentially the 1s orbital of the carbon atom or of the nitrogen atom. They're tightly held near the nucleus. They don't distort very much on bonding. They still look spherical. And fundamentally, they're very boring, right? So we're going to forget those, forget the core orbitals, and just look at how the valence orbitals look. Okay, so there are eight valence orbital electrons, and they'll fit in pairs into four molecular orbitals. So we're particularly interested in the four orbitals that are not the 1s orbital, right? And they turn out to have energies like that. One pair has the lowest, and then the other three orbitals all have the same energy, which at first glance seems surprising. When orbitals have exactly the same energy, they're said to be degenerate. There are three degenerate molecular orbitals for methane, right? For ammonia, it's the same number of electron pairs, right? But now there are only two degenerate molecular orbitals, and one is higher than the others, and we want to understand why that is. Okay? Now, let's look at some of those orbitals. Let's look first at the lowest valence shell orbital. Okay, there's what it looks like for methane on the left and for ammonia on the right. And if we looked really, it looks like a 2s orbital. Bear in mind, what do the colors mean? The blue and red up at the top. There, what's plotted is the square of the wave function, but the color has to do with the sign. So there's opposite sign of the wave function in the middle and outside in the outer sphere, right? On the top, it's blue outside. Here, it's red outside. Does that make a difference? Could I have made this one blue on the outside? Yeah, that would correspond to multiplying by minus 1. And you can multiply a wave function by any constant, and it's still just as good. So it's really arbitrary what the sign was here, plus or minus. It happened to be the opposite of what was up above, but that's no different. Okay, now, this one has a little core of density down near the middle that we don't see here, and the reason we don't see it here is we put the atoms. But if we make a finer plot and take the atoms away, incidentally, these subsequent ones are going to be contoured at 0.03 electrons per cubic angstrom. We can see this node, this spherical node down in the middle. So this is indeed a 2s-like orbital. Okay, now let's go on to the next orbital, that one. What does that look like? It's a p orbital. Everybody see that? It's the px orbital. Now, the next one is this, which looks funny this way because the red's on top of the blue. But if we rotate it toward us at the bottom, then we see that that's a p orbital too. And notice it's been distorted, as the first ones were, by the protons. The atomic p orbital would look like this, symmetrical. But these protons pulled out of the nucleus stretch the top out this way and this way, right? And the same for the ammonia, right? And here's the last of the valence shell orbitals. So that's a pz orbital. Again, it's stretched out here. Now, notice on the right that there was no proton here. That proton, the one that's here, was still in the nucleus to make it nitrogen, right? So this electron, this one isn't as stable as the others because it doesn't have a proton up here where it's dense, right? So it's higher in energy. It's not the same. These three p orbitals are exactly the same way as they are in an atom because they all have protons out there. But this one lacks a proton there, so it's higher in energy. Makes perfect sense. Okay, now that orbital then is called the HOMO, the highest occupied molecular orbital, right? Now, there are other orbitals, and incidentally, that particular one is Lewis's unshared pair. Okay, so that's the one that makes ammonia a base. Now, there are other orbitals that are unoccupied, right? Here are some of the unoccupied orbitals, right? Now, would it be sensible? This is the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital of ammonia, right? What should we call that one, that red one? Is that the HOMO, the highest unoccupied molecular orbital? Is it? Chris? Oh, you can have an infinite number. So there's no, you never call something the HOMO. Okay? But HOMO and LUMO are very important. The highest occupied and the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital will turn out, as you'll see shortly, to be really, really important. So we talk about those a lot. Okay? And notice that those are 3s orbitals. They have a spherical node here, the same way this one does. Right? And if we rotated it to see it from the bottom, you can see the spherical node here. Okay? And there's another one that would be way down near the nucleus. Okay, and now this we're looking at the unoccupied orbitals. Okay, so this is the 3d x squared minus y squared looked at on edge. It's more clear if we rotate it, right? And you can see that it's like this, those four lobes, except that these protons have pulled up this one and pulled up this one, right, in both cases. So that's the molecular 3d x squared minus y squared. Here's the 3d xy. You can see that it's this clover leaf shape, and it's better if you rotate it, right? But again, it's been distorted by pulling this one out, pulling this one out, pulling these down a little bit toward that proton. But fundamentally, it has this kinetic energy shape of a 3d xy orbital. Or here's 3d z squared. I particularly like this one because, see, what's happened is this donut around the middle has been pulled down wherever one of these hydrogens came down. Isn't that cute? So that's the z squared. There it is rotated up. Okay, now you can go to more complicated molecules like ethane and methanol. So there, now you have seven pairs of valence orbitals, and we compare it to argon, which has seven electron pairs. So there's the 2s orbital of argon. There's the orbital structure for occupied and the lowest ones of the vacant orbitals for ethane. And here's a pedantic note that you don't have to worry about at all. I just put it in there in case anybody happens to worry. You don't have to remember it. But here's the 2s orbital of methane. So you see what it is a sphere that's been distorted vertically by pulling the nuclei apart to give the two carbons, and then pulled out into little lumps by each of the protons going out to be a hydrogen. And there's the same thing. If we rotate by 90 degrees, it looks the way shown on the right there, right? So it's a lumpy sphere, right? Now, if you did the same thing with methanol, right, now the two nuclei have different charges, the O and the C, because we didn't pull two protons out of oxygen to make it into a carbon, right? So now we have a much bigger nuclear charge here than here, so it pulls that sphere up in this direction. And when it's up here, it gets pulled out that way, but it doesn't get pulled out this way by the other protons the way ethane does. And here's the 2pz orbital. So you can see, especially, it's more symmetrical at the top, of course. You can see clearly that it's a 2pz orbital. And now here's a 2px orbital. Now notice that the 2px orbital in ethane is higher than the 2pz, because this one has a node where the carbon atoms are, where so much of the positive charge is. But the other one had the horizontal node, so there was a lot of electron density where the charge was, the positive charge. Okay? And here's the 2py orbital, which you can see not so clearly here, but if you rotate it, you can see it has this node here. It's 2py. And here's the 3s orbital. So it has this spherical node here and also here. But of course, much more distorted in this less symmetrical case. That's this node. So that's 3s. And here's 3dxz. You can really see that clover leaf and also here. Or here's the 3dyz, which you can see over here. Looks like that. Or here's the 3dz squared. I like this one. Right. See, what happens is that inner tube that went around the middle, that donut, every time you come to a hydrogen on one top or bottom, it pulls it up or pulls it down. So it's up, down, up, down, up, down as you go along. Isn't that cute? Okay, or here's 3pz. You see the spherical node here? Just like 3pz of the atom. Or here's 3py. You can see the spherical node again, plus the vertical plane. Or 3px, where you see the same thing over here on the left. Or 3dxy, which isn't so good in this. If you turned it down, you would see that it's red, blue, red, blue. Okay? 3dx squared minus y squared, the same thing turned by 45 degrees from the previous one. Again, if you looked at it from the top, it would be red, blue, red, blue. Okay? I love this one. That's the 4F orbital. Look how accurately it maps the 4F atomic orbital. And you can go even to a more complicated molecule. I'm going to just zip through this, and that'll be the end, okay? So here's one fluoroethanol. Where were the very lowest electrons be in this molecule? The lowest pair of electrons. Sebastian? Well, the fluorine has the biggest nuclear charge. So the very lowest is the 1s of fluorine. What's next? The 1s of oxygen. What's next? The 1s of carbon. Which carbon? Ah, the one near fluorine and oxygen, because they're taking electron density away. Okay? And then the last core orbital is over there. But we're much more interested in the valence orbitals. Okay, there's the 1s. It's mostly on fluorine, right? But distorted by the other charges. There's the 2px. Here's the 2py, which has the node going down here. It looks like a hybrid orbital more, right? More to the right than to the left. And if we rotate it at 90 degrees, you can see that it's like a hybrid y orbital. Or here's 2pz. Now notice here's the atomic hybrid orbital with pz and a little s, and here it is here. Okay, or here's the 2PZ, which points down, the other hybrid orbital. Red here, blue there. Okay, here's 3DXY, red, blue, red, blue. Right? So, which contour should we use? If we use a single united atom, we can see something interesting. This plum pudding perspective shows the generality of kinetic energy-based clouds of electrons, that's what's doing it, just as it does in atoms. But if you want to understand bonds, you have to probe harder. So you have to look at this contour, and that's what we'll be doing from here on out. Okay, that does it. Right.